Welcome to Let's Talk About It, co-hosted by Maria Wyatt and Scott Dudley. Presented by Imperial County Behavioral Health Services and brought to you as a podcast by KXORadio.com.
Good morning, Imperial Valley. You're listening to your weekly wellness radio, Let's Talk About It, with your host, Scott, and yours truly, Maria Wyatt. We are brought to you by Imperial County Behavioral Health and KUBO 88.7 Radio Bilingüe. Our phone number here at the station is 337-8874.
Welcome. Thank you once again for listening and joining us. And, yeah, again, no, hey, call, because it's cool when you get phone calls, 337-8874. So if, you know, you personally know the person on the radio or something, or whether you have an opinion on something or whatever, you know, just weigh in. Really, no, it would be great. Come on.
Our guest is kind of being, he's hesitating.
Yeah, okay. Coincidentally, the topic today is our guest.
Which is
today,
perfect.
Yeah, yes. Our guest today is wait. I don't know. I know your first name. Which last name do you go by? I'm sorry. You've been married since the last time I introduced you on the radio.
It's hyphenated.
Okay, so I can do that. I can do that. It's Natalie Rodriguez Flores.
Yes.
Hyphen Flores. And Natalie is a has a master's in counseling, and she's working towards her MFT marriage and family therapist certification. She's an intern, and she's a mental health counselor for the Imperial County Behavioral Health. Been doing that for what, two, three, somewhere around there, huh?
Wow.
Year and a half, something.
Not a year. It's since 2006.
Yeah, how's it going for you?
It's going not fast enough. I still
how many more hours do you need?
600, about 600.
Oh, that's you've done quite a few hours then.
Yeah, yeah. Out of, you know, the 3,000 that are needed, so I guess it's not too much more.
So looking back on this process, if you'd known what you know now about the process and the requirements and the work that you were doing, would you still do it?
Yes.
Yeah, cool.
I think I would have gotten involved in CBT like from the beginning, though, because, you know, in school, it's just very generalized.
Dump all that Frankel. Humanism. Yeah,
yeah,
it doesn't pay the bills. Come on. Okay, 337-8874 is the phone number. The topic today is panic attacks.
And it's, and you know, it's a good subject because with all these rumblings of earthquakes, you know, just people are still afraid, you know, and just, they might have, you know, they were already scared of earthquakes.
Even more so.
That it might come back.
Yeah.
Just the thought. A lot of people are getting nervous, just the thought that it's going to happen again. It's just,
I'm sure it's going to happen again.
I know. And it is going to happen again, but some of them just...
Well, I've noticed a trend with my clients, increase in symptoms.
Because
as far as the anxiety part of it, I mean, they have multiple diagnoses, but they right now with what had happened with that earthquake, the aftershocks, they're going through a lot of symptom stress, particularly just with the aftershocks. And fortunately, they have that support group, right, through Sunshine.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So several of them have been calling that and participating in that. That's been helpful. And others are just kind of waiting by the door. Unfortunately.
Or waiting underneath the table. Covering.
You know what's interesting is not quite the same. With the adult alcohol and drug people, at least, there's actually been kind of like a wave towards recovery, interestingly enough. And so It seems like, and just kind of, this is observational, I haven't been like taking numbers and counting and doing statistical reports or anything, but it seems like there more people are a little bit more serious about what they're trying to do with their lives in the recovery side of this thing. So,
what do you think that means for them?
Big earthquake, oh my goodness, I'm mortal. This is big, you know, or maybe it was like,
like a life-changing experience?
Well,
sort of.
Not only that, it was one of those experiences where if you were actually under the influence of something, you may have felt yourself impaired to the point of self-endangerment. And that may be driving that bus, too, because, oh, geez, I never know when I might need my sobriety to help save my life because I need to be able to, like, navigate something without falling over, you know, or something. I don't know.
But going back to panic attacks, what are they?
panic attack.
Well, not a little spike of anxiety, is it? Is
no.
It more than that?
No. Typically, off the top of my head, I can't think of all the symptoms, but you need...
Is your heart racing numb because you can't think of all the symptoms?
No.
Shortness
no,
of breath?
It varies from individual, but it's under the DSM, it's 4 symptoms that need to peak within 10 minutes. And it could be anything from heart palpitations, shortness of breath, sweating, feeling numb, hot flashes. The thoughts also, as far as fear of losing control, fear of death, things like that. But it really varies depending on the individual. And some can even say they can experience like the peak up to an hour or so. Like it slowly over time it gets to that point.
Mm-hmm.
It just, again, depends on the individual.
Why do they happen? Why do panic attacks?
Well,
yeah, Natalie, why?
Why
is it happening?
Why? Is it just something, you know, just something traumatic happened, or?
Or body chemistry, or?
Well, there's several different triggers. With each individual, the best thing to do is a case conceptualization to get a better understanding of that particular individual situation. Typically, what I've noticed, a lot of them have experienced some sort of strong emotion, maybe anger or the depression. Something had happened that caused a shift, and it sent them into a panic. It could have been physiologically something. Maybe they... drink a lot of caffeine, and it just sends them, and you know, there's those little shots of caffeine that people take, and they don't realize that it could just, with the adrenaline, they don't see the connection. So it's really exploring the initial one, and then from there, unfortunately, they don't see it, because it happens, it's so sudden and unexpected, and then, in a sense, there's this fear of, it might happen again. They might start avoiding leaving their home or going places because they're fearing maybe they might die, they're going crazy, something like that.
Well, and to them, I guess, it sounds like it happens outside of their perception of control as much as anything. And if something's outside of your perception of control, well, by golly, it could happen again.
Yes. And it's just a misperception in general because we all experience anxiety, right?
Mm-hmm.
That adrenaline rush, and for them, they just should be the risks. They just misperceive it, and also their resources. They don't realize that it's something that they can cope with, get through, or.
So if you broke, what I hear you saying is if you broke a panic attack down and you kind of broke it into like a millisecond reactions of thoughts and physiological reactions, that there's a distinct escalation process going on in the individual that is kind of a synergy, but it's a synergy that they're participating in a weird way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're not aware of it. They're not really consciously guiding this or by any stretch of the imagination. But at some level, my heart's racing. That's a problem.
Yeah.
And then something else happens because you perceive it as a problem, and then that's a problem, and oh my God, I'm dying, and that's a huge problem.
It just escalates.
Yeah, because they have the underlying beliefs, and with having those underlying beliefs, they normally have automatic thoughts, right? And so automatic thought, when something happens like this, is likely...
A heart attack, I'm dying, I think, with most people. That would kind of push you off the edge.
I'm
sorry, I'm almost 50 now. This is something I have to think about.
Yeah, and it's hard to distinguish at times because some of the symptoms are so similar to what you may experience in a stroke, likely with the numbness. But at the same time, when it becomes something that's such a pattern and they're going to the hospital, I've had clients who have told me before even beginning treatment, they were going to the hospital every month or so when it let
they thought it was having a heart attack.
Yeah, and even in denial or disbelief that it was a panic attack, they're like, "No, why are you telling me I am having anxiety or giving me a shot?"
So for it to happen once, I guess would be really understandable because if you're having a catastrophic health event. And you believe you are anyway. That's worth getting excited about, typically. But you go to the doctor, and the emergency room, presumably, because you're having a heart attack or stroke or something awful is happening. And they say, well, no, I'm sorry. You're like, everything's okay. And now that keeps happening, but you already know that once this has happened to you, you were okay. And but you still can't buy into that belief. Mm-hmm. Now you've got a panic attack problem, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. And how many people this typically come in for behavioral health services? Is this a fairly common thing that you might see?
And age groups, how is it always? Any young kids? Any?
Well, I haven't worked with children, so I wouldn't know.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as my experience, I'm assuming there's a large number of children who experience it as well. But in the adult population, most often when they have, say, even depression, they likely have some sort of anxiety disorder. Mm-hmm. PTSD, they have an anxiety disorder.
So there's almost always an element of anxiety working around people with mental health problems.
Yes. And I think in the DSM, it's about last DSM, because, right, the new one should be coming out. Hopefully.
I'm watching my mailbox.
It's, I believe it's at 3.5% population. It's likely more than that, I would assume, maybe.
Those are the people who are reporting it, huh?
That's true.
337-8874 is the phone number. We're talking about panic attacks, baby. With Natalie Rodriguez-Flores, who's one of the MFT interns and a counselor at Behavioral Health. So what must it be? I mean, for people who have experienced panic attacks, it's not something, obviously, because there's treatment for it. It's not something you kind of step out of in the middle of it and just say,
or look forward to
I'm
it.
I'm having a panic attack. No big deal. Relax.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that must be, think of it, it must be hard to do.
It must be scary. I mean, just going through those.
It's like you've been hijacked. It's like your cognitions and your body have been hijacked, and this process is running out of control, and you're watching it in horror going, oh, my God, is this really it?
I'm assuming that, you know, people who have panic attacks don't want to have them, but they're just, and they're afraid, and they don't know how to cope with it.
No.
So that's when you come in.
Well, and I think even more so with children. I know with adult population still there's that fear, but with children, because they're so unaware of their emotions and you know, they're learning to recognize certain things that they're experiencing, I think it would be more difficult for them.
Mm-hmm.
And especially knowing if a parent's not very supportive or not cognizant of, you know, what that might be.
I'd throw out an exception, though. My exception would be this. Most children aren't really walking around wondering if they're going to have a heart attack. So.
No, but if they were... Because sometimes you have a panic attack, and not necessarily you're thinking you're going to have a heart attack. It might just be, in general, I'm scared, I don't know what this is.
Just freak
something
out.
Something is wrong. So not all individuals say it feels like a heart attack. Not all of them say it feels like I'm going crazy. Or you know, it really depends on the individual, because some... say they experience images that come to mind when they're having them, and a lot of people don't.
I just remember going through the earthquake. I was with many family members, and some of my family members, the adults, panicked. I mean, they started, you know, like screaming and, you know, just lost control, and their kids reacted the same way. You know, I just kind of my cousin's fiance grabbed my daughter, and I grabbed her, and it's just that was just not saying anything. I was just quiet, and my daughter was just fine, you know, because she, after it was done, she wanted to go look for the Easter eggs. Continue, but you know, I'm just saying, you know, could it be that children also? I don't know.
Well,
I mean.
And speaking to some of the parents that. Because it was on Easter Day, I had heard from several of my clients that when their children saw them panic, then they noticed that their children began to panic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also the age as well makes a difference. So if they're at an age where they're becoming more independent, aware of themselves, their surroundings, then that also makes a difference. It wouldn't be the same for someone who's like, you know, maybe like two or something, or or even four. You might just think, oh, it's fun. But then you have like an 11-year-old or 13, and it's like, what is going on? The world is.
Well, and for little ones, for like 2 to 4 year olds, I think a lot depends on what emotion they read in their primary caregiver.
Exactly.
The primary caregiver's like on the ceiling with their claws. Then the kids are going to be, no, this isn't fun. Their primary caregiver is scared to death. What's going on here? So there may be that element. But with panic attacks, typically there isn't that much. Can it be tied to an obvious stressor like that? Or is it more, I don't know, more inherent, its own little event?
Traumatic, maybe a flashback or a traumatic event?
If it would fall among the categories of the triggers, I mean, because it could be anything that's a change of an emotion. So if with what they felt, the anxiety just in general sent them into a panic in that moment, or with the adrenaline that maybe rushed through their body, then that could have sent them
into a panic. So it could be tied to an environmental occurrence, like an earthquake.
Even exercise, too, if they just push themselves to a point where...
the point none of us push ourselves.
Obviously. No. Exercise? What is that?
And, of course, with the substances, right? But you had mentioned how the clients at ODS, the recovery is a little different for them right now.
Again, just observationally, it seems like, you know, it's like one of those kind of, oh, geez, life's really important. I need to
dial in. I remember one time, I don't know if it was kind of how people feel panic attacks, but I had my wisdom teeth were pulled out all at once, and, you know, they gave me Vicodin for the pain, and they worked really good. Every 6 hours, you know, it would hurt, and it would fight.
And we never saw Maria again.
And you know, my throat was starting to hurt, and it was hurting a lot, and I took a Vicodin. I thought it was still my mouth, you know, I thought it was still my wisdom. Took a Vicodin, and just within minutes, I just started to feel chills, sweat, my heart was beating fast, and I thought I was going to die. I really thought I was going to die, and it was scary. It was scary. It turns out that I had an infection. Developed infection, I guess a Vicodin infection just didn't go well. And
so you could chemically induce a panic attack.
What I was mentioning about the substance disease.
And it felt, I was scared. And after that was done, I just started to cry. I was just like, because it was just, you know, the fear of dying. Am I having a heart attack? Because I've never had that ever, you know.
That sounds pretty classic, actually.
And, you know, that just, and it's still in my memory. I don't want to go through that again. So, I mean, and people who have them, not just once, but often, I just...
It can be really debilitating.
Yes.
You know, can I go do this? They aren't able to do their daily, you know, life, you know, their daily routine.
They become significantly impaired to the point where they start missing work and missing work.
When is it going to happen again?
I'm not even going to go to work at all anymore, or even leaving their home.
Drive a car. If they happen while I was driving a car, that may be a problem.
Or some even, they'll drive cars, but they'll stay within their city. So, you know, they live in Brawley, and they'll just stay within Brawley because the hospital's right there. If they need to, doctors are there. They know where to go.
So I trust myself enough to pull over and, or even drive to the hospital.
The control and the safety and knowing,
So if someone walks in and this is what's going on, what kind of stuff do you have to check as like an intake clinician? What kind of
intake?
Well, you know,
general intake.
Like an assessment thing. What kind of stuff as a clinician? What kind of stuff do you look for to kind of nail down what you're going to be do to begin to help? I guess.
Well, I think the first part would be the symptoms that they're experiencing. Because, like how I had mentioned, it varies from individual to individual. And so just getting a better understanding of what they're experiencing, the intensity, frequency, duration of it.
We'd almost have to rule out health problems with something like that.
Exactly.
Huh?
And especially even with some of the treatment as far as symptom induction.
And then how often? Yes, and then how often? Because, like, for example, I guess I had one. But that just happened once. And that was it. and for somebody that has, you know, how many times has this happened?
Yeah.
Typically, would it come to mental health after having been gone to the, maybe like the hospital a couple times and them saying there's nothing wrong, maybe you should mm-hmm. go to mental health?
Yeah, I've noticed that.
Yeah, that seems like that would be illogical because the person's feeling like they're having some sort of body issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's a somatic type of experience.
Yeah.
Combined with the racing thoughts of impending doom.
Yeah.
So they probably typically would have a healthcare provider would run across this first.
And typically. Then there's the others who have just been trying to manage on their own, but slowly becoming more impaired to the point where maybe they're prompted by a family member, friend, or maybe they lost their job and they realized, you know, it sent them into a stage where they're contemplating there is a problem, right? The whole stages of changes. So.
So you see, so someone walks in the door and they've got this, and you check your symptoms mm-hmm. to make sure that's what they have.
Yes.
And
diagnosis, right?
Yeah, right. And do you check? I suppose you check triggers and stuff too.
I attempt to.
Is there a way to manage this contextually? I mean, that's pretty much failed so far with mm-hmm. people because they've cut their life back and dialed themselves down, as you were saying.
Well, that's something that usually has to be more addressed during treatment, during therapy. Because at intake, it can be very emotional for them. Mm-hmm. They're just like, you know, really expressing a lot of things that they've been enduring for a very long time. And notice in that moment, sometimes they don't realize connections or they can't even determine frequency, intensity, duration. It's like, I don't count how many
been
times.
Measuring
exactly.
It just happens.
And so once you get to the point of treatment and you're able to provide them with some sort of handouts that they can monitor.
Monitoring.
Then that it really makes a difference at that point in treatment. Mm-hmm. And then getting a better understanding, like how I mentioned about the case conceptualization of the things that maybe childhood experiences that maybe have got them to that point. The automatic thoughts that mm-hmm. come to mind and
nice.
Doing work with that. So.
Nice. I'm touched, I guess, a little bit by how assessment, it's like there's a couple of like mutual needs going on because mm-hmm. you've got a need for this like scientific stuff to quantify whatever you're trying to determine is the problem. And it sounds like they have a need to begin to share some of their life experiences with someone who's, mm-hmm. you know, they've never, you know, sit down and talk to grandma about my panic attacks. You know.
But, you know, with Natalie, having as I think I've had my, the clinician, Natalie's my clinician, her voice is so soothing.
Thank you.
I mean, okay, I'll tell you my whole life story.
I think that's typical with a lot of clients that come in. I've noticed that when I give them screening forms before the intake process, and you have these perceptions. You see these clients in the waiting room, and in your mind, you're not exactly sure what's going on with them. You know, you see what's written as far as a presenting problem, maybe anxiety, depression, and they could just be barely holding it together because I've noticed that they'll come in and from sitting down, it's like they start crying or just like they let it all out and just been holding it there. Mm-hmm. So it's really finding a balance between getting the stuff that you need, mm-hmm. like how you were saying, and at the same time validating what they're experiencing and exploring and providing them with much aid as you can in that moment. Yeah. So
especially, they probably felt, you know, alone, you know, who, even if the family wasn't very, you know, just not, they are not understanding because they don't have the information. So, you know, the support.
Yeah.
So we touched on panic attacks and we're going to talk a little bit more after the break about how we do for treatment. And walk us through treatment so, you know, restore ourselves. And this is Let's Talk About It, sponsored by Imperial County Behavioral Health. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with the rest of the show.
You're listening to the complete podcast version of Imperial County's Behavioral Health Service, Let's Talk About It, brought to you by KXORadio.com.
Welcome back. You're still listening to Let's Talk About It, your weekly wellness radio. for Imperial and Mexicali Valleys. Our phone number here at the station is 337-8874, and we are brought to you by Imperial County Behavioral Health and KUBO 88.7 Radio Bilingüe.
Aren't you glad you're listening? Hey, we're back, and I'm Scott, and she's Maria, and over on our right-hand side is Nelly Rodriguez Flores, who is an MFT intern, mm-hmm. mental health counselor for the Imperial County Behavioral Health Services, and working with adults, working, station up in Brawley, or where are you? Well, I know
I'm
where you are
Brawley
now, but...
now. I actually got promoted.
What are you now? What do you call yourself now?
Supervisor one program.
Congratulations.
Thank you. For anxiety and depression clinic. So I was just told yesterday.
Very cool.
Oh, good. Perfect.
Are you going to be like a working supervisor then? Is that part of this would be you continuing to do a little bit of a gig so you can get your hours in? Or?
I'm hoping. I have to explore that still. Oh. So, yeah.
Very cool. Very cool.
It's going to be a change.
So when are you going to take your position?
I'm not sure. Yesterday we were talking about determining a start time because they have to have a replacement clinician and I have to train that individual. And then I have my therapies too, so I need to... It can't be
That's
abrupt for them.
Okay, bye.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact,
so
we really need about 600 hours of closure here, ideally.
No, that was, I wouldn't move for a long time.
But you get your license. That's kind of where I was going. So welcome back. 337-8874 is the phone number. Panic attack is it's the topic of the day. And we're talking, kind of talked the first half hour about, you know, maybe where they came from and what they look like. And so now we need to spend a little time talking about what to do with these things. And they're tricky. I mean, mm-hmm. panic attacks are really beautiful little contraptions because they build so beautifully on, they use the body's physiology,
yeah.
Which means they use all of the kind of, I don't know, for you listeners, if you've ever had 4 or 5 cups of coffee because you thought it was going to keep you awake, and all of a sudden you felt this palpitating kind of uneasiness in your own body, and that tends to be part of this thing pretty typically. And what happens, I guess, after that is your brain interprets that energy as potentially harmful
mm-hmm.
and releases a bunch of neurochemicals in, which tell your body to release more adrenaline. And, of course, that is interpreted as proof that whatever's happening is harmful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And pretty soon you're off on this. You've managed to – it's like a cat that crawls off on a limb. And you go farther and farther and farther on this thread of reality that, oh, my goodness, something really bad's happening here. And all of a sudden you're way out on this little skinny little limb and the branch is going to break. And by golly, you do have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a panic attack.
Yeah.
Hello. So and it's so debilitating that people come in and get mental health treatment for it because for some people can have one and walk away, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Like me?
Yeah. Yeah.
Never want to have lucky. You never want to have one again.
And other people get, I guess, in a rut and get some sort of habitual
pattern,
which begins to interrupt their life, mm-hmm. their jobs, their relationships, their hobbies, life pleasures, essentials,
daily functioning,
showering,
and then
whatever.
There's some people that have them but know how to manage them.
Is this something that people quietly suffer through, do you think, Natalie?
Yes. I think so. There's a lot of individuals who don't talk about
it. But you'd have to have a panic attack that was somewhat, I guess, marginal in terms of intensity. Because if you had a real full-blown panic attack, unless you did it in the privacy of your bedroom or something, you'd be scaring people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you were gonna like gut it out or whatever, you'd have to do this in a way that. It wouldn't be too bad because you'd have to be able to pull it off in public without people calling 911 for you.
Well, and I think a lot of them are very evasive when it does begin to happen because it is a process as far as...
Oh, so it starts coming on. And
yeah, and then how they interpret it, and usually, I mean, for them to get to that point, they misinterpret it. They catastrophize, mm-hmm. right? And likely, by the time it gets to the peak... they might be in their car.
So one of the one of the elegances of the disorder is that it allows you enough time to individually get to a place. So basically, if you think of this disorder as trying to survive, as trying to avoid elimination, it actually cuts you enough slack so that you don't get into trouble with it out in public. So you can go enjoy your panic attack in the privacy of your own home where people won't worry about you. And that way the panic attack gets to keep coming back for another day because it doesn't come to too many people's attention.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that beautiful that this occurrence has such a will to survive?
It's beautiful. I'm like,
Well, it's neat the way that it sets it up, because if it just knocked you down in the middle of the street, you know, you'd have to take action to deal with it almost immediately. But if it comes on slowly enough that you can hide it,
mm-hmm.
or deal with it yourself because of the shame and stigma of mental health, or, you know, whatever, then that's kind of, it almost speaks to the panic attack, you know, having its, like, I don't want to die, so if I do something too obvious, they're gonna stomp me out here. If I do something just subtle enough, maybe people won't get treatment because of the shame or...
Mm-hmm. But some of them do end up at the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
So those are the people that they do want to...
And some rely on that form of treatment for a long period of time. You know, they are in denial. They don't want to. The whole stigma of mental health treatment.
But they're having a heart attack.
Yeah,
they're having a heart attack.
Just keep going back to the hospital and give me a shot, anti-anxiety.
Yeah, yeah, there you go.
And I don't.
Which of course works.
It works, yeah. I don't need to go and see someone do mental health. I'm not crazy or, you know, typical.
Well, again, stigma.
Yeah.
So what is the treatment for somebody that has been diagnosed and has, you know?
Well, it's lengthy. And, with any diagnosis, you have to do psychoeducation first. And like how I mentioned before about getting a better understanding of their symptoms, we have various forms, I think. Smucker, Mervyn Smucker gave us another one that... Dr. Mervyn Smucker gave us one.
Smuckers, it's good.
Has to be good.
where clients can check the symptoms that they're experiencing, specific thoughts they're experiencing. So getting into the rhythm of monitoring them, getting a better understanding of the thoughts and symptoms, the feelings that they experience.
As you pointed out in the beginning, people typically aren't keeping real close track of this thing.
No, they're not.
They don't know how long it lasts. They don't know how often.
Mm-hmm.
They just know they have them.
They have them, yeah. And so it allows them to have that ability to begin to explore them and evaluate them, because there might be a pattern where they have them at night, and compared to an individual that has them at varying times throughout the day. So what does it mean for them to have them at night? So it's something we have to look at. And going back to childhood experiences, you know, maybe if they're able to recall the first time they had one, if they were younger, or even things that maybe happened in their household. Maybe the parents were very strict. Maybe the mother was very tense, had a lot of anxiety, and that kind of just got
downloaded.
Yeah, I think it's you're 8 times more likely to experience panic disorder if it's already in cross generations and family. So.
Nature or nurture, either way, you get a wild card there.
Exactly. So,
337-8874 is the phone number. Natalie Rodriguez Flores, MFT interns, the guest. We're talking panic disorders. Give us a call because this is, you know, it's okay. You guys driving around out there listening. This isn't like it's never happened to you. Okay, you know, typically. Panic, having a single occurrence of a panic disorder is not the rarest thing in the world.
No.
It's you know, the people who maybe reach the level of needing treatment, maybe 3.5%, as you suggested. But certainly feelings of intense being out of control and fear and that whole moment isn't, I mean, it's a rite of passage, wouldn't it be, or something? Okay, so but you're saying there's a context to this. Let's go back to this. You're saying that an understanding the context can sometimes help people to manage the onset.
Mm-hmm. So you, like how I was mentioning, you explore childhood experiences, just things that happened in their life, and then get a better understanding of automatic thoughts related to beliefs. And so if they're experiencing beliefs that are right, sociotropic, those are related to feelings of love, or
yeah,
they had some issues growing up,
mm-hmm,
or if something related to autonomy is the other, helplessness. Most often, it's helplessness.
With panic.
It's yeah, that, right? And so,
that was with me.
Well, yeah, well, because panic, I mean, panic's natural cousin's helplessness. I mean,
mm-hmm,
it's not, a lack of feelings of love isn't going to cause my heart to race.
Mm-hmm.
However, being out of control in a
yeah,
crazy world might.
Yeah, being out of control, you know, you yeah, don't know what to do.
Yeah. And so, how I was mentioning about the monitoring,
yes,
they begin
yes,
having panic logs, and with those logs, they can explore patterns, when they happen, what time in the day, and thoughts that come to mind, irrational thoughts, and even allows them to reframe those thoughts.
Do you see, Is do you ever see an improvement just because your message coming out of these first couple of sessions is this with your psychoeducation, I suppose, is this is not entirely uncommon and it is entirely manageable. Is that alone enough to get people balanced on this?
It can be. I provide them with handouts that describe the facts of anxiety, you know, as far as it being something natural that happens in the body, and explaining mm-hmm, the process. And then also the handouts talk about that they're not going to die from this. You know, it feels like it, mm-hmm, but they're not going to. And the basic deep breathing exercise is very helpful for them. There's so many out there, but the basic one tends to be easiest for them to apply, because mm-hmm, I don't think they want to do imagery while they're at work. So, you know, they do simple breathing exercise, breathing from as far as their stomach up, diaphragm, fully with your mouth closed through your nose,
mm-hmm,
36 seconds.
It's like what Joe Frazier said in right before the Thrilla in Manila when he fought Cassius for Muhammad Ali. I think he's 73 or something. Remember that?
No.
I was 10.
No, I was 23.
What he said was kill the body and the mind, the head will follow.
Mm-hmm.
And his whole point was he was going to, you know, body punch Muhammad Ali into submission. But in this terms with panic attacks, it's like if you can manage your body through breathing, if
mm-hmm,
you can control your physiology, your mind will come into line.
Mm-hmm.
Is that's kind of where you're going with this?
Yeah. And the other part of treatment is symptom induction. And well, with symptom induction, you really have to rule out any type of possible medical problems that might get in the way of participating in that exercise. Because
like propensity to die or what?
No, they would have to have some sort of evaluation. You know, I wouldn't want a pregnant woman doing hyperventilation.
Okay, yeah, there you
right?
go. Yeah, good point. So let's break down the Latin of the word symptom induction. So you actually are going to make a panic attack happen? Is that what you're saying?
Specific symptoms. Not necessarily the whole onset of a panic
attack. Oh, okay.
Attack,
so
hyperventilating, right? Or, they say swiveling in a chair.
And is that what happens when you do that? Doesn't it just like lead to more meltdown?
Well,
explain the process.
It's a process for them. I mean, you have to introduce it and present it to them.
Mm-hmm.
If also, again,
you
not
can't just break surprise them.
No, surprise! You're gonna hyperventilate right now. But
it would actually happen faster that way, wouldn't it?
No. So it's a process, and throughout the process, at the end of it, they're basically supposed to get to the point where they're able to see the connection between their the thoughts and their role in the anxiety and bringing it on at times.
Hmm.
Specifics, yeah.
So you get this person into, like, physiologically
yeah,
into a fairly overexcited state.
Mm-hmm.
So they're breathing too fast, they're getting dizzy,
mm-hmm,
their heart's pounding rapidly, trying to keep up with the oxygen, I suspect,
mm-hmm,
and they're dizzy and
mm-hmm,
they can't focus. And then what do you do to them? Give them the bill.
No.
No, well, of course you would have to evaluate the thoughts they were experiencing in that moment. And again, most often it's the catastrophizing that it's just seems normal for panic, catastrophize. So, and the misinterpreting. So they're able to see that and see the connection between the symptoms and the thoughts that they have. And I lost my train of thought.
That's easy enough.
But
happens to me all the time. Don't worry about it. Another train comes in like 20 minutes. You just got to catch
the next one.
Or making it worse, aren't I?
Yes.
So what you're doing is then is the thoughts of somebody in this condition are typically, I'm going to die, this is horrible, I can't stand this, there's no way my body's going to make it through this.
Mm-hmm.
And those thoughts typically aren't exactly true. They're typically a little overstated.
Mm-hmm. But what if, you know, that's what they think. You know, okay, you're saying that I'm not going to die, but what if I did, you know, it could happen.
Well, then you'd be dead and won't worry about it, right? I mean, downward arrow that.
Yeah.
But I mean, yeah, that's, yeah.
Yeah. That would be the other view of it. So.
Then I'd be the one having the panic attack and do CPR to revive you or something. Watching their license flash before my eyes.
Typically, how long is treatment for somebody that has been, is going to see you for panic attacks?
Well, they all get 12 sessions, and so, but some tend to terminate early. I've had some clients who, with just even deep breathing, the relaxation, even some refocusing and monitoring with the dysfunctional record, it was enough. They didn't even have to get to symptom induction. And I've even had some clients who couldn't participate in symptom induction, or they declined.
What is symptom induction?
It's when you bring on a specific symptom, like hyperventilating, feeling dizzy or something like that. But I've had I had one client who had asthma. I had another client who had multiple health problems that just, like, I'm not going to try that.
Something more gentle.
Yeah.
Well, so with symptom induction, you know, it occurs to me, with symptom induction, you get two great gifts that keep on giving, because you get the gift of getting to go through your thoughts because you've actually gone to the state with the person. But you also had to come back from that experience, and so now you've got some actual in vivo practice on on how to bring yourself back from this heightened body state.
Yeah, and that can be very powerful.
So you practice the breath in ways that you know, in the room, you're practicing the breath.
The deep breathing, having relaxing music for them as well. And there's the refocusing exercises too. Maybe it's like a distraction in a sense. You have them read something so they can attempt to distract themselves. A lot of individuals with panic attacks, so I've even had individuals who at time of intake, they begin to have the onset of a panic attack.
Oh, wow.
And
that's the right place to do it.
I know.
You've got professional help.
No, I don't know the percentage, but I've noticed a pattern where they don't want anyone to speak to them. You see it happening, beginning to happen, but in the beginning of it, they're attempting to take control of it, trying the best that they can, and they don't want anyone to speak to them.
So they sit down.
It's like, don't talk to me. And they mention family members who, like, it's okay, what's wrong with you? Like, and it just sends them off more into panic. And they just kind of
is that typically how someone eventually, when they are able to manage this condition, is that typically the strategy that they need is just to be able to concentrate on managing it essentially?
Most often, yeah, they need something.
So that they're kind of intuitively going to the right place. Maybe it's not working as well as it could because they may not have the right tools.
And then the family members not knowing.
No, the external stimuli, it's just too much for them. The noises, people questioning them, not understanding, and at the same time, this person is having shortness of breath, their heart is racing.
Well, which are universal signals to have somebody stop in and ask how you're doing, right? I mean, so unfortunately, it's not like, you know, we're not butting in. We have a legitimate concern.
Well, then that goes really to the family. You know, what do you tell the family? Do you educate them? What should the family do when somebody's going through? What should I do? I mean, I would like to know. I mean,
well, I have the clients. I don't have too many of them that are interested in having partners come or family members come. You know, it's always an option for them, but it doesn't happen too often. But I do provide them in the psychoeducation part, providing them with information related to the anxiety that they could share with their family members, and even for them to share with their family members what they're experiencing, the thoughts that they experience, because a lot of them just keep it to themselves, and they don't want to be seen a different way. And at the same time, these people around them are not really helping them because they don't understand.
Well, because we've done a lot to non-normalize extraordinary states of consciousness. So it's just, it's not cool, basically. It's a sign of weakness or something. You know.
So, yeah, it could be also cultural.
Well, yeah, yeah.
I
don't know of many cultures where the inability to handle your mental state is viewed on with a kind of smile and, well, it's okay, it's normal, it happens to everyone sometimes. You know, pretty much it's like, ooh, you're one of those people. It's like, whoa, stop. So are you. So, okay, so you come in, they get 12 sessions. Some people are able to begin to manage this systematically and begin to cut down incidents earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Others have more trouble? Is this something that can be really sticky?
It can be, and I think it's more often sticky when they have multiple diagnosis. They can have trauma. They can be obsessive compulsive at the same time, you know, and then not only have a panic, but maybe they have the generalized anxiety, so they have like several
packed on the stove. So you're cooking like five different things at once, and it's hard to pay attention to the one thing.
You're trying to address it all within 12 sessions. So, I mean, there's extensions, I'm not saying that, but for therapy, but you're trying to do as much as you can. And that's why it's very structured and very intense, and a lot of work.
How do you get, with 12 sessions, how do you deal with rapport and buy-in? I mean, there's some bridge building, I would suspect, in working on somebody and knowing them well enough to be useful in your work, and them trusting the system and trusting the process enough. Well, and also, let me throw in, I guess, the bonus prize. Is there may be some secondary gain associated with any sort of mental health situation. I mean, so maybe this person's getting the family all rushes around them, and this is their moment, and they never get any other moments. And, you know, a part of them, you know, would never really admit that this was their moment, but yet there it is. So there may be some secondary gain also too. Mm-hmm. In 12 sessions, it must be a challenge, I guess.
Yeah.
To build those bridges, to get people organized, because this is also a big part of this is really self-management in a way that hasn't been taught or practiced prior.
Yeah.
So you get a crash course in self-management.
Yeah. And necessary. Yeah, necessary. If there is a need, it can be extended.
Uh-huh. Yeah. It can be extended. Take it to team.
Well, even in saying that, I mean, my own little self-panicky way of organizing the world, if someone didn't bring their homework back the first week, I'd be like, oh my goodness, we've only got 11 sessions left, we need to get this done. You know, I my own little urgency, I guess, to get, because 12 sessions, then clock's ticking, you know what I mean?
No, but they're supposed to.
The imperative in the room is like, okay, well, we're down to 11 sessions now.
Mm-hmm. Well, and exploring the reasons why they didn't do the homework, was it difficult? Do we need to explore something else?
So in some ways that could actually build rapport more quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because you've got something obvious to begin to talk about. Huh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Neat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and if it's a pattern, you know, it's like they're not in that stage of change that
they're not ready for.
No,
the therapy they're not ready for.
Yeah.
And
they have other things going on. You know.
When they're ready, they can try again.
Uh-huh.
That's the light bulb in psychologist joke. Don't even go there. When does a light bulb... How many psychologists does it take to change a light bulb? Well, only one, but it has to want to change. Right?
Yeah.
All right, thanks. Natalie,
No, no, go ahead. I just have to, quick announcement. Sunshine Clinic is having a free seminar this Saturday from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. At 1073 Ross Avenue, Suite C. And the seminar is on stress. And it's going to be held in Spanish. And it's going to be on stress, on how to handle, saying that physical and mental health as well as family relationships and work can impede seriously your stress or can cause stress. And then saying to reduce stress and to live a better, healthy life, the seminar can assist you. So it's a free seminar. It's on stress and then how to handle stress and how to live a better, healthy life without
from
stress.
2 to 4 this Saturday. You
from
have an 2
to 4, yes. It's 1073 Ross Avenue, Suite C. And the phone,
right,
if you need
next
more
door to Buckland Park.
Yes, right next door to Buckland Park. That way, you know, you can, after the seminar, you be stress-free, walk on Buckland Park, and, you know, be in the moment. And the phone number is 353-7667 if you need more information. Again, this is a free seminar being provided by Sunshine Clinic. And, again, it's this Saturday, May 8th from 2 to 4.
Tell them you heard about it on Let's Talk About It, and they'll give you a free... No, they won't give you... They'll say, oh, really? Cool.
It's free. That's why. It's a free seminar. Yeah. You know, what better opportunity? You know, you get a free seminar. You have it. She is Norma Muñoz. She is a psychologist in Mexicali, and right now she's going towards her MFT license.
She's an MFT intern also.
She's also an MFT intern, but she is a licensed psychologist in Mexico. And it's going to be in Spanish. So it's for our listeners who have families that, you know, speak English or knowing or speak Spanish or understand Spanish, this is a great seminar.
Aprovechen.
Yes. I'm going to tell my aunts and my mom and everybody.
Thank you, Natalie, for coming aboard.
Thank you, Natalie.
Today. Appreciate it. It's always fun.
Thank you. We'll see you again probably next month, right?
And if you want to hear this, or if you've got people who have panic attacks and you happen to catch the show today, remember, podcast on kxoradio.com. Okay? Join us there.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Have a good weekend.
Let's Talk About It, heard each Thursday morning at 7:30 a.m. on KUBO 88.7 FM, Radio Bilingue, presented by Imperial County Behavioral Health Services and brought to you as a podcast by KXORadio.com.